This is Vectis Radio. For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome to this week's special Christmassy edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis. And a guest that will be really familiar to you, our very own Marco, a.k.a. Mark Newland. Welcome, Mark.
Good afternoon, Joan.
Hello. And your regular listeners will know Mark from his Wham Bamalam show. I want to say Wham Bamalong Ding Dong. That's it, isn't it, Mark?
Wham Bamalam, that direct.
Okay, Little Richard. And his Mod Anthem show. And we'll be talking about that and so much more, because Mark's got a fascinating backstory as a bit of a Fireman Sam.
It is, yeah. Actually, a Fireman Sam or a Fireman Mark, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So lots of heroic tales that wow. I think we all want to hear. No, they're going to be really heartwarming for Christmas,
yeah.
Aren't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the story at the end regarding Romania will be a very good one for Christmas, yeah.
Yeah, so tell me, you were born in London, weren't you? Yeah, southeast London.
I was born in Bermondsey, yeah.
Yeah, and now you find yourself on the island.
Yeah.
How long have you been here?
Nearly 30 years.
Love it?
Yeah. Oh, still love it, yeah. Most islanders say you'll never be accepted as an islander, which goes with the run of the things. Yeah, but I would never go back. No. I've got no need to go back anyway. My parents have all gone. But no, it's the best thing we ever did, getting the opportunity of transferring down within the fire service.
And did you raise a family here?
No, but I came when the kids was 5 and 6.
Uh-huh.
So I got a good opportunity to come, and they loved it.
Lovely. And are they still here?
My son is. He's a car mechanic, and my daughter's a paramedic back in London.
Wow.
So, yeah, the story goes on.
And you haven't lost that accent?
Apparently not.
No.
I haven't
definitely
got a little pile of white slant on it, no.
Definitely not, no. No, no, I think that's lovely, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can tell immediately where you're from. Yeah. And let's just clear this up once and for all. So I've got you down here as Mark Newland, but we all know you as Marco. And when I invited you on to be my guest, I thought, oh, there's going to be this wonderful Italian heritage with the dark hair and this Marco name, you know, and I was even hoping for free samples of ice cream and pasta, but nothing's been forthcoming, has it?
No.
So this is why...
unfortunately, there's no Italian in there at all. It's the dark hair colouring comes from Ireland, Irish.
Okay.
And it is my real colour. Everyone says, do you dye it? And I said, no. But, you know, I'll get that to the dying day. My grandfather was dark, my dad was dark. So it's all my own hair. But the slant on Marco actually comes from when I was a real nipper. So, you know, that's an Isle of Wight.
Oh, it certainly is.
My mum and dad used to hold down a couple of jobs, as they did them days. And I was asked to be looked after by one of these ladies that she worked with, and she was Italian, and she had 3 daughters, and she used to look after us in the morning, take us to school, and she used to say, well, I'd love a little boy, and she said, how are you going, Marco? So that was my first influence of that, and then for some reason over the years people latched on and said Marco, blah blah blah, eventually to Vectis Radio, and Ian said, well, you know, what's your name? I said, well, it's Marco / Mark. And I've worked on the idea of Marco, Lucky Boy Newlands. A lucky boy comes from the fire service, mm-hmm. and away we go. So I answer more now to Marco than Mark, because sometimes people say Mark and I'm looking around. But that's how it comes. But unfortunately, Joe, no red wine or spaghetti connections.
Oh, okay. Or mafioso.
No.
That's just as well. So I'm not in fear of my life. Good. But has Ian got a name for all of us that work at the station, or nickname?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
Would you tell me if he had?
If you had one, I'd let you know. Off air, of course, but no,
best I don't know. Dread to think, really. So, you are a real life hero, aren't you? You're the man that every little boy wants to grow up to be.
Well, I wouldn't say I'm a hero, but it is a great job, it still is a job, but I've been out of it. But I never really joined the fire service, I never thought about joining the fire service as a kid.
Oh, so it wasn't the dream.
No,
what was your dream?
Driver.
A bus driver.
Driver or a train driver them days, you know, you was big important up the front. But how times unfortunately change. But I was working, I've worked various places as a sign writer at the beginning, and I worked for a customs place, and eventually Hayes Wolf, a shipping clerk. There's an advert in the Daily Mirror. There are other papers, but it was the Daily Mirror.
Yes.
It was offering £5 more. So with a mortgage, as you do, I applied and I got accepted.
So back then, was the training as rigorous as it is today?
Oh, yeah, yes. It's nothing's changed. It's 22 weeks it was in London. And it's quite intense. Physically, it was no problem, I'll be honest. The arithmetic size and the English side was quite intense.
Arithmetic?
Yeah, because not a lot of people realise when you go to the training school, they knock you into shape for 6 weeks.
And so it's a bit like being in the army.
In the army, yeah.
Squaddy bashing.
You are marching about and all sorts, and get up the haircut and have another haircut. I've had one, we'll have another. But in that 6 weeks, they sort of mould you. And then after that, you get what they call classroom work. So every day, there's half of practicing drills, techniques, knots and lines, breathing apparatus, first aid, everything. The second half of the day is what they call classroom work, which is arithmetic, English, learning hydraulics, sciences, building construction. All that goes in. You have to know all this stuff. So when you have your pass out week, which is roughly on the 21st, to the 22nd week.
And you don't mean fainting, do you, Mark?
No.
Heaven forbid.
No, pass out. It's actually called pass out of terminology. Yeah. And by then you know your station. You've been allocated your station. Mm. And then you go from the training school to your station, where you're treated like quite abysmally, because this is another proverbial from the training school.
What do they? Are you rookies? Is that what they call you?
Like rookie, yeah. Mm. Rookie would be a posh word, yeah. And then you know from that time when you arrive, regardless of your age, it's 5 years before you can qualify. So you technically do 5 years and 4 months before you're qualified as a full-time operational firefighter. And not a lot of people know that, as Michael Caine would say.
Yeah.
It takes a long, long while.
Yes, but and so it should, shouldn't it? Because it's a hugely responsible, dangerous job.
Yeah, and as I say, the amount of stuff that you do know, I'm never going to get through this, but you do. You eventually do, and it's such a fulfilling job.
So that's the physical training. How do they train you emotionally, mentally, to build you up for what you're going to have to face?
Well, those days, and I think it's not much different, there certainly wasn't any counselling afterwards.
No counselling?
No.
Okay.
The days when we were talking about training for road traffic accidents, they call them now road traffic incidents for some reason, because they said there's not such thing as an accident. There's another argument. When you're training to do RTA work, road traffic accident work, the best thing they showed us was coloured slides from the Moorgate tube crash. Do you remember that
one?
Yes,
I was going to ask you about that.
And that was a few years before I joined. And they said, here we are, lads. This is how do you react to that? And of course, it's horrendous sort of photos. And that sticks in your mind, and away you go. And then as you're doing RTA work, they show you various slides of people that's unfortunately died or been crushed in vehicles, and that is your sort of mental training.
And I'm mad. Do you lose people at that point? Some people are filtered out.
You lose people quite. I mean, there was 25 in my squad, and it whittled down to 11 by the time we sort of passed through. Because there used to be things, I digress a bit, there used to be things in the fire service called hook ladders, which was an old-fashioned Victorian way of rescuing people. It's a special ladder that you took on your shoulder, and you pulled out a great big like a hook bill, and you smashed that through the windows, and you can climb physically anywhere with a hook ladder, rescue people and bring them down. And when you used to practice that, it would be always on a drill tower, which would be at least 60, 70 feet up, and you'd climb. There's no lines on you those days, no health and safety things, and people would say, there's no way I'm climbing up that, and they'd walk as well. So it whittled down to about 1,000 people.
Yes, goodness. Did you have any moments where you thought, actually, no, I can't do this?
Not really, because, say, the main push was that I needed that extra £5 to go towards the mortgage.
Yeah.
It was a simple
half. So you had that incentive.
So that was it, and I thought, I cannot fail here, because I'd already given up my other job as a shipping clerk. If I fail, or get back squatted, as they say, which puts you back another 4 weeks, we're going to be in problems here with the mortgage, so you had to get through. That was my incentive.
And did you find that it affected you, that it changed you as a person?
Yeah. For the better,
I think.
For the better, yeah. You do have to work as a team, without a shadow of a doubt. You can't do it on your own. Anybody who says that, you can, you can't. So we worked as a team. And that developed right the way through my work in life, the teamwork. And I think that's, where we are at Vectis, really. You still work as a little team, don't we?
Absolutely, yeah. And you have to, I would imagine, that team, it's absolutely imperative that it is cohesive. Mm. And you haven't got any mavericks deciding to be the superhero.
No.
And pull the whole team down or disrupt things.
There are checks in place before you go, just say, for example, into a burning building. This all happens super quick. Because you just kick in, but you'll turn up at a fire, say in a house, and if you're driving, you've got to know where you're going. You have to learn every street wherever you are. So you have to learn every street on the island.
So it's like the knowledge.
Topography. It's a bit like
London,
taxi
yeah.
And you know London, how big that is. But even with the Isle of Wight, there's some weird and wonderful names that are not even in the book. But you have to learn that. So as a driver, you need to get there sharp. The officer in charge, if you become an officer in charge, he has to decide on... He's not worried about getting there. He has to decide what the job is, think in the head, how will we attack the fire, etc. Are there people involved, persons reported? So by the time you roll up, as a driver, I'll be looking for a hydrant. The three or four lads will be putting on breathing apparatus. There's a man on there called the breathing apparatus board operator, a BA board operator. You have to report to him first. You must report to him. He takes your night, your name and your time. These lads then go into a fire, do what they can, or hopefully get a result. And the man on the board then has to make sure they come back out. And they're all on time. So as you can see, everyone has to work together.
Oh,
and it does work.
Yes.
There's no maverick. So if there was a maverick, it would go wrong.
Yes, oh, for sure, for sure. What's been your most heartwarming moment of going into a burning building and, you know, you come out and you think, well, that was a really good day's work and something that just stays with you?
Well, that's quite hard. If I go back to my very first job at Lewisham, although I was trained to wear breathing apparatus, you wasn't allowed to actually wear them on the run, so to speak, for 1 month. Why, we don't know. So I turned up at this flat in Greenwich, and it was well alight. And there was a lady, she wanted all the personal goods, and she was coming over the balcony, and she's throwing everything over the balcony. I'm on the bottom of the ladder, supporting the ladder while the lads are up there. And they're saying, no, please stay in the flat. And she said, no, I'm coming down. And so she was climbing onto the ladder, and so this guy had to come down. So I had to go up to the ladder, and I had to sort of bring her down. And that was one of the first jobs I think myself, this is what it's all about, because this lady was absolutely traumatised, but she wasn't going to let her possessions go either. Obviously, she's hard up.
Yeah.
And I helped her down. She said, thanks very much, son. That was 20, 25.
Yes.
And so that was a fulfilling one. And another one is like when you do go into certain fires and the officer in charge, or the governor, as they call them in London, would just say, look, we've got persons reported in there. There's a couple of kids. You've got to find them. They could be in a bedroom, wherever. And you have to do a search routine in thick smoke, so you can't see. It's just, and eventually, when you do come across them... and there's a 50-50 chance that they are still alive, or they've got smoke inhalation. Mm. You get them out, you give a bit of first aid on them, hand them over to the paramedics, do brilliant jobs. And when you know they've survived, you know, you can't get a better job feeling than that.
Of course not. Goodness me.
Obviously, it goes the wrong way. Yeah. You want to know. But so there's all sort of examples, but a bit like RTAs. If you get someone out of a car and you've saved them, for whatever reason, it's great.
Of course.
It's a great feeling. It's worthwhile.
And do you get, I suppose you're saying this lady wanted her possessions, do you get people who are adamant that you've got to go in for an animal and pets?
Yeah.
That must be very
difficult.
That's,
quite hard, because you have to sort of convince them, you know, at the end of the day we can go in, but we're there really to rescue the people. If we can rescue your animal, your pet, we will.
Yes.
And there's lots of controversy over bits and pieces, but that's the way it is. We would, if we have to, we brought a couple of dogs out and a cat. A goldfish bowl.
Really?
Yeah. So
it's all that personal stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
That it, you know, in that moment, like you say, somebody's very traumatised, but I imagine they're completely crystallised onto who or what they want to save from that building.
Yeah, you do, yeah.
And is it that classic thing people always talk about, wanting their photos? Do you get that as well? Did you get that a lot?
What, want a photo with you?
Oh, they want to save their photographs.
Oh, yes, yeah. Definitely the photographs. I mean, I'd be the same. We have a run through at home, and... if, God forbid, it ever happened, I think in the loft, if I could get there, it would be the photos.
Okay, definitely. So what, you do fire drills at home?
Yeah.
Do
yeah.
you?
Yeah,
wow.
I still do a basic one. I mean, I always say to people, just say, for example, at Vectis Radio, Ian said, well, we have to have a fire drill plan. So I put it together and people go, what a load of nonsense this is. So I said, well, I can see it being annoying, but try this. You know, I always say at home, close all your curtains, turn the lights off, spin yourself round, and then try to find the door instantly. 9 times out of 10, people won't find it. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
You know where it is, but to try and do it and just spin round in the dark.
Because we know all about smoke detectors, you know, they've done huge advertising campaigns and promoting the how essential they are.
Yeah.
And I think people, well, so you've got the message about that.
Yeah.
But what you've just said is a brilliant way of testing, isn't it?
Just test it, you know. What at home as well, like with the smoke alarms. I don't think this has changed either. We always say change the battery in your smoke alarms when the clocks go forward or back. So every 6 months, they reckon, change a battery. So if you get into that habit of when the clocks go forward in March, battery, Christmas time, or October rather, battery. And then when you do the change in battery on your smoke alarm, then do a little fire drill.
Yes.
It's so simple, but it does sit in there a bit.
Exactly, and I think also if you've had one of those incidents that I used to have the whole time when I was in London, thank goodness I haven't had any here, but I was always setting the alarm off with my cooking.
Yeah.
And bashing the living daylights out of it with a broom handle to get it to stop.
Yeah.
And because obviously you're panicking, you had small children to feed, whatever, you know, you're tired from work and you're just giving the merry hell to this thing, then it stops and you think, oh, for goodness, thank goodness, and you go to work the next day and you completely forget to replace the thing that you've just broken.
That's
really important.
And especially this time of year, and I would imagine it still goes on, is when there's toys at Christmas, they think, oh, I need that 9-volt battery, a little square one.
Mm.
Where have I got one? I'll just take it out the smoke alarm for today.
Ah, right.
It always went on. And then, of course, months down the line, you go to a fire, check the smoke alarm, no battery. They meant, oh, I meant to change that.
These are really key things.
Simple little things, but it does happen.
We should all be more aware of, for sure.
Definitely.
Yeah, because it's that classic thing, never going to happen to me, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, that's for sure.
Just not going to happen.
And of course, going on to your smoke alarms, set off a lot by the toasters, they've got more refined now. You've got little clear buttons, so you can knock the alarm off, or you have heat alarms as well in the kitchen, because it's always a smoke.
That's right.
Or buy a bathroom, the steam sets them off.
If there's anyone listening who is inspired by what you've said, and what qualities do they look for in the recruitment area? I mean, you'd obviously clearly recommend it as a great job for the right person.
Yeah, it's a fulfilling job, definitely.
You won't get
rich from it.
Really?
No, I mean, unless you're a flyaway officer, which pays big dividends at the end, but you always need the troops on the floor, don't you?
You do.
But as a fulfilling job, it's brilliant. But I would say, if you're looking for something different, you want to help people, and you like that little sort of extra edge, it's worthwhile, and there is quite a bit of respect for the service.
Oh, very much so. And the camaraderie, working as a team.
Yeah, I mean, the camaraderie, you can play loads of sports within the service if you want. You can represent brigades at all sorts of sports. That goes on boxing, football, hockey, anything like that. But the camaraderie is there, and it will make you a better person. That shadow of a doubt, it'll make you a better person. So, you know, if you're thinking about it, please apply. Or you always see adverts are saying, oh, we're not recruiting. They might not be, but if you're writing, they keep you on the books and they may write back.
So it's worth applying. Brilliant.
And I believe the age for applying has gone up. It used to be a cut-off age was 31 for ordinary civvy street people and 33 for ex-Navy. But I think it's up to about 35 or 40 now.
Okay. Presumably you need really good eyesight and things.
You'll
like
need 20/20 vision,
and hearing and things like
to
that.
Apply. They allow for... They didn't. They used to throw you out on your eyes once, but... which if they did now, I wouldn't survive, but 20/20 vision to go in, and you can't be colourblind.
Okay, so that's Ian would be out.
Ian would be out, yeah. Ian's red and greens are different for you, unfortunately.
Don't apply. But you say changes people for the better. How has it changed you?
Well, I would say where I was brought up with, and this is not like swinging a lamp, you either become quite an aggressive young person to survive in some of those areas, or you was picked on, say. And I would say by joining a brigade, the aggression went. You know, you took the aggression out at training school. You become a better person. You see people in a different way. You see society in a different way. And that's how I think it changed me. And I quite like talking things through now, which years ago you probably wouldn't have done. So that's the way it helped me, really.
Yeah, and I should think after a day doing that, you would come home, you wouldn't have the energy to be aggressive or to pick a fight, would you?
No.
Because I imagine it puts everything in perspective.
It certainly does, yeah.
Because what you've seen has got to be far worse than any petty arguments going on at home.
And I mean, back at the fire station anyway, There's always people in walks of life, there's a natural pecking order, and they would have a laugh and a joke, but you'd always get someone who's a bit aggressive, and within a team that was sort of dealt with. The officer would say, you know, you lads are going to have to sort it out.
Wrap the fire hose round him.
which they did, you know.
Yeah. And what about, you know, you see these lovely days where the kids go in and they clamber up into the, you know, the driver's compartment. Is that still happens?
That still happens, yeah. I mean, I know they do that in Newport. You'd invite scouts and cubs in and all sorts. And the first thing they want to do is put the fireman's helmet on.
Of course.
And 99% it goes on back to front.
Oh, lovely. And over their eyes, presumably.
Yeah. It's a strange thing. And then they want to put the fire tunic on and they want to squirt some water.
And do they want to go slide down the pole?
If they can, yeah. Well, you can do a little bit at Newport, but at Lewisham you couldn't because it was like three floors, so it was a long, long pole. But that's it. That's the ideal. And we always say to them, what do you want to do? I want to be a firefighter.
Yeah.
And, of course, with the introduction of females back in the 80s, you can now say no problem at all, because I did find that sort of off-putting. There was loads of young kids come, girls, and you knew for a fact up until a certain point they loved it, but they just couldn't apply. You can now, can't you?
Brilliant. Yeah, well, in London they've got the fire commissioner, new fire commissioner, Danny Cotton, a lady.
Yeah, she's risen through the ranks. She's the first one, I think, in Britain. I think there's one in the States, but there's not too many. And I think she's late 40s, early 50s.
And what do you think a woman brings to, you know, being a firefighter that a man perhaps doesn't have? What qualities?
Well, I'll give you an example. At Lewisham, we had the very first lady firefighter. She was on Blue Watch, I was on White Watch. And you always, you know, people would deny it, but we had officers come around and said, there's this lady starting in a month's time. You cannot F and Jeff, because that's part of the
job. Swearing, yeah.
None of that goes on. Any sex remarks, anything like that, you're out the door.
Mm.
And you get the old people that, the old special Navy boys, it's always, because naturally the Navy used to always go into the fire service first, because you used to do a lot of firefighting in the Navy. And some of these old sweats used to say, I'm not having this. But you would see the old sweats change as well. And I think it just made you a bit more respectful.
Yeah, so
you had to sort of hold your tongue.
Yeah.
And then you think to yourself, yeah, actually. And then one of the officers come round and said, just put it this way. If your daughter was the firefighter that was going to start, how would you want her to be respected? How would you want her to operate with her? And that was, you think to yourself, yeah, that's correct. And most of the firefighters took that on board. You always get some that didn't.
And presumably once the older guys saw how well the women coped with the job, they had respect for them, so it all kind of went hand in glove. Yeah.
And I always remember the first lady, her name was Sue Batten. She ended up being a station officer or commander in Devon before she retired. And on her days off, she was quite open. She said, on my days off, I have to go into the gym to keep my strength up, just to be at the same level as you guys. So she said, there's always that physical difference.
Of course.
Mentally, she was way ahead of us.
Yeah.
Spoke fluent Russian and all sorts. But that was an omission from there. And I think blokes accepted that.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, how it is now.
So we're going to take a short break, but please stay with us, because we really have got a genuine heroic tale from Mark afterwards. And I want to hear more about his music. And I think there's lots more about Marco that we need to know. So stay tuned and do a bit of Christmas wrapping in the break, or have a mince pie and a glass of sherry in the second half of sound. Sound brilliant. Okay, speak soon.
Putting the community back into local radio. This is Vectis Radio.
VectisRadio.com.
For the people, by the people.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my special guest, our very own Marco. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you very much for the second half.
And we were talking, well, I promised you a heroic tale, and I think it's time, I think we need to hear that now, because it is Christmas and it'd be lovely to hear something heartwarming. So tell us about Romania and your role in that.
Okay, well, Romania was, as I said earlier, about just 6 months after the collapse of Ceausescu and the communism in Romania, a couple of officers from Wiltshire Fire Service was contacting some various firefighters to deliver a couple of fire engines to Romania. Fortunately, I was approached, and the officer said, yeah, go with it. So we took it to Romania. It took 7 days to get to this place. And what I did see there was the Romanian Fire Service, although Romania gets a lot of bad press now, at the time they had virtually no fire service, huge lumbering trucks, and it was paramilitary. They were very young lads, untrained firefighters, etc. So when I came back, I said to my chief fire officer, sure, what happens to the old fire engines? Because the old fire engines on the island, one are about 20 years old. What do you do with them? He said, well, they're sold to Africa for about £500. So I said, what would be the chances of having a couple of these and delivering to the Romanian fire service? Not a chance, was the reply. So I said, well, there might be a bit of kudos in this. I'm interested, he said. So then we went to the council, and it's the same sort of thing. No, kudos, yes. So cutting the story short, we took a couple of fire engines the following year to Romania, to a place called Oradea. And eventually the Romanian fire service said, well, we need some trucks all over Romania. And the final trip, I've done six trips, the final trip was a place called Suceava, which was only 50 miles from Russia, the Moldova end. And this is a mountain city, but they're suffering quite a lot with road traffic accidents, so they wanted a rescue tender. So we got permission to take one of the old fire engines off the run, convert it into a rescue tender. Took all it. We put an advert out to all the fire service. It was getting rid of all their old road traffic cutting equipment. We renovated that, took it to Suceava. It took 10 days to get there. And we carried out some drills and some exercises, showed the lads what to do. And on one of the last days, the chief fire officer, who was a very stern chap, we said, we noticed a difference in his sort of approach to people. And I asked his number two what would happen through a translator. You know, he was only speaking Romanian like English back. And he said, oh, his son's just had a bad accident. He's had his eye poked out virtually with a friend playing sword fighting with a stick.
Right.
And I'm sorry to hear that. And eventually the father came back and said to our main officer, is there anything you can do for my son? There's nothing can be done in Romania at all for this injury. So I said, well, we'll do our best. So we came back, and my brother-in-law at the time was at a top orthopaedic surgeon. I said, do you know anybody that can operate on youngsters' eyes? And he said, yeah, I've got a colleague I know, works out at Nuffield in Southampton. So we got in touch with this guy, Andrew Luff, his name was, brilliant guy. And we had the x-rays flown from Bucharest to the Nuffield. He said, yeah, he can do the operation, but it would cost £9,000, which was a lot of money in the late to mid-90s. And we raised this money through various events, through the, you know, like garlic festivals and being it to win it and competitions, like, yeah, like all the emergencies, like everyone does, really. Raised the money, and eventually we made the following year, I think just on the start of the year, so he had this injury for about 8 months. We flew him over with his father, and he was operated on three or four times over the next couple of years, and he's got over 50% of eyesight back in the eye.
Oh, wonderful.
And the climax of that sort of story is that this young lad was 8 years old then. He's become a doctor himself. He wants to put something back into society. And he sent us an invite to his wedding last year, and we attended the wedding this May.
And was that in Romania?
That was in Romania, in Suceava. And it was fantastic. And as I said to you earlier, the wedding was fantastic. They got married by the mayor, the formal side. And then they get married in a church, and it's a very, very good service. They both have crowns on their heads and all that sort of thing. It's
goodness.
Really something like wonderful. A Greek Orthodox sort of look about
yes.
it, you know. And then we had the big service afterwards, and then the food and the drink. And the evening started around about 8, and it went through to 10 the following morning. I made it to about 4 o'clock with my wife, dancing all the way. I got pulled up on me dancing. He said, the man always stands up, like the old Greek dancing, you know.
Ah, of course, yeah.
Anyway, that was great. And
did he give you a mention in the speech?
He did give us a mention, yeah. And on the very final night, we stayed round his parents' place in Suceava. And his dad, who's a very stern, communist-thinking man, through Catalin, his name is the son, he used him as a translator. He said, I think I'd like to say that as a communist, we definitely got it wrong. He said, I've seen some people today in the fire service that work as a team. They're brilliant people. Everyone's benevolent. And he said, I feel ashamed of being like at that level. And to say something like that as a real, because his father and all that age group had always just been brought up. They had to speak fluent Russian. Everything was communism. They knew nothing else. And at the time, I wouldn't be wrong in saying this, all the emergency services were quite corrupt out there at that time. Yeah. So he's obviously gone through that system as well. And to say that was quite humbling. So it was tears from him, tears from us, tears from his son. And we keep in touch regular.
That's lovely, because obviously that wasn't actually anything to do with your job, was it? It was just a coincidence you were out there at the time when that happened.
Pure coincidence, yeah.
And you happened to know someone who could help.
That's right. And it's his mother. She keeps in touch quite a lot. And she said if it wasn't, you know, from, you know, the act of God or whatever, he would have lost his eye. It's just the way things
and
work out.
And had that happened, perhaps he wouldn't have gone on to become a doctor.
No, he wouldn't have done, and perhaps would have slipped within the system that still exists in Romania now. So,
well, there you go. So you are a superhero, Marco. I told you you were.
But it was a good story, and it was great doing it.
I can see
that was a spin-off.
You've got a cape on under that jumper, haven't you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's wonderful to just be able to do that and say you've done that, and it's lovely that they keep in touch with you.
Well, I said to Ian that the boy, Catalin, and his young wife, Teodora, they are coming because he's having his eye checked next year around Easter time in Southampton.
Right.
And when he comes, we'll get him into the radio station.
Wow, brilliant. You know, so it'll all go full circle.
Full circle, yeah.
Oh, how lovely is that? How fantastic. But I know the job, from what you were telling me earlier off air, it's lovely when you have these moments when you can do what you're there for, what you've paid for, and what you want to do, obviously, with your heart to save people. But it's not always like that, is it? And you've had some pretty traumatic events in
Clapham
train crash, and you were involved in Zeebrugge, weren't you?
That's right, yeah.
A ferry disaster. I mean, we're going back a little bit for our younger readers, but, you know, we're talking about hundreds of people dying, aren't we?
And, well, that's right, I mean...
But hundreds of people being saved, so more people being saved than lost their lives. But to witness something like that must be...
For younger listeners, it wouldn't be any different now. You'll see P&O ferries and all that. If you can imagine a P&O ferry that goes across from Dover to Calais, this was there's a company called Townsend Torsen,
which
P&O brought out in the end. That's the size ship that went out and tipped over. It was full up with people because there was an offer in one of the national newspapers. You could go for £1 to France for the day. So there's hundreds and hundreds of people on there. And through a fluke of, let's just say it was an accident, the bow door was not locked. And the water coming onto the ship, and they reckon within like 30 seconds it rolled over onto its side. Only a half a mile out. And I think it was about 150 people drowned. But when I was on duty in Lewisham, you operate from a teleprinter system, which, if you look at the old London's burnings, you'll know what I mean. It's
yes,
like a big fancy typewriter.
Drama.
And the station officer said, we've got an ordering into Kent. We had to do a standby duty in Kent. I said, it's strange. He said, well, they've committed all their fire trucks to this incident. And somebody said, what's that? And he said, there's 700 people missing on this ship. And that's a huge amount. We had to double check. And then we got ordered down to Manston Airport. And there's five ETs, emergency tenders, all across London. And all five was ordered down to Manston Airport in Kent. So Hertfordshire and other places then had to cover London while we was committed down in Kent. We flew to Belgium and we was under the command of the German fire service. And the idea was, it never turned out that way because by then they'd all drowned. The idea was to get onto the ship with infrared cameras, hunting for hotspots and things like that. But that never came about. So all the equipment went down. We was flown out and was out there for 2 days. And we just assisted the Belgians and the Germans with that one. And the Clapham rail crash, well, if you just look that up, that was a horrendous sort of free train crash. And the emergency tenders always get ordered onto there. And that's for cutting people out, saving what people you can, and acting respectfully for the people that didn't make it.
And having witnessed something like that, because yes, you're there to do a job, but you are also a human being, and you do see things that thankfully most of us never get to see in our lives. How are you supported after that? Do you have counselling? Is that there
for you? At the time, there was no counselling, no. I believe they get it now for all sorts of individuals and incidents. But basically, you'd go back to the fire station when you was ordered back. You'd have to clean all your equipment. You'd have to clean yourself up, change of uniform. And you'd have a cup of tea, and 9 times out of 10, there'd be some sort of black humour, I suppose, gets you through that. And before you know it, the bells would drop again, and out you go. And then that job's finished. You're focused on the next job.
Move on.
So I would imagine being at a busy station was quite helpful. Mm. I would imagine if you was a very quiet station, you had a traumatic incident, you've got time to think about
it. Yes. Yeah, but then you're on to the next one where hopefully you might save someone,
right,
and that,
yeah,
that even thing, yeah, it must, yeah, be very, very difficult though. Do you think that that's had a long term effect on you, that side of it?
I would, at first I'd say no, but as I'm getting older, I do seem to have, not flashbacks, but some strange dreams.
Really?
Yeah, only a little while ago, I said to Macca that I was at the fire station at my age, looking what I look like, with people that I can remember. He was on the trucks when I was 20, and I'm trying to put on some fire kit that's not there, and I'm panicking.
Oh, I
where
see.
Is it?
I see, in the dream.
Where is it? Yeah. And then we go into these sort of car crashes, and I'm operating with no fire kit on. Where's my kit? And the officer's saying, where's your uniform? And I'm sure these things are slight, they drift back from you.
Oh,
and
they
you
must
do get
do.
You do get flashbacks and bits and pieces, but I think you know, you just go with it.
Yeah.
Whether it has any long term effect, who knows? Possibly, that's why I'm working at Vectors. No.
So, I just wanted to say that I love Isle of Wight. The fire station looks so lovely at Christmas, and what fills me with absolute joy is when they put that lit Christmas tree,
yeah,
on the top of this fire station in the centre of Newport, and you can see it, and no matter how grim you're feeling and bar humbug and miserable,
yeah,
you see that and it literally lights up your life. Well, it lights
is,
up mine,
yeah,
isn't it? And so how did they get it up there every year and make that effort? I just,
well, that's lifted
wonderful.
Up by the hydraulic platform, which is called,
yeah,
a Bronto sky lift. It's like a great big crane,
uh-huh,
that's,
yeah,
lifted up there, and the lads get it up there. But the actual tree, the story behind the tree, mm, is that one of the lads who's still there, he's getting on a bit now, but he's still on duty, Matt Sainsbury, his name is. The connection comes from his family, and they get a tree every year from Parkhurst Forest.
Oh, how great
is
that?
And it's donated to the fire service, and they get it up on the crane. The chief officers have always given it a permission, and up it goes. They secure it, and they light it up, and it's magical for Newport, isn't it?
Oh, it is. I mean,
yeah,
it makes my year every time,
yeah,
I see it, I think. And if it wasn't there, it just wouldn't
right,
be the same.
Yeah,
yeah, no, it's lovely. And like I say, I love the fact that they bother to do it.
Yeah, they're always good. I mean, they get some bad press, they get some good press, but generally you can always rely on a firefighter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And one year, I don't know if they do it every year, but one particular year, a friend of mine she said to me, get yourself down into Newport with a car. I said, why, what's happening? She said, the firemen will be washing the cars for charity.
Yes, they do,
yeah. Yeah, she said, when I went around, she said, they were queuing all around the block.
They do, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant. That's not every day you get to say that,
no,
is it?
That's right. And that goes to a lot of the Fire Service Benevolent Fund or whatever other charities they're sort of supporting. But it does work well in the summer, because I can remember when it's a hot day, you've got your tunics off, the guys are just there in their leggings.
Stop it, Marco, please.
And the people queue up.
Mm.
And it raises a lot of money. That's what we leave
well, that's
it that
the way to do it, then,
that's
isn't
the way
it?
To do it. Yeah,
you see, I've kept very clear of any puns or any innuendo.
That's
because
right.
I thought I'd do that, my short-lived career at Vectors Radio will be up in flames.
No, you're all right.
Boom, boom. But no, so I've stayed well clear of that. But just very briefly, because we're running out of time here, tell me about the music man in you. Where's that come from?
Well, I think it's come from my grandfather. It was First World War in the trenches, etc. All the family played harmonica or mouth organ. And he could really play the mouth organ, but he could also, which was I find quite strange as I got older, he could play the blues on the mouth organ. And I think listening to blues music got me into sort of the old R&B, not the new R&B, and rhythm and blues, and I sort of liked what I heard from there. So then I started following groups like the Yardbirds and the Animals and people like that, a bit of the Rolling Stones, and that's how it got me into the music. Then as I got older as a teenager, I quite like the motor scooter look and the sounds that went with that. And basically then there was a few of us that used to listen to the pirate stations, which was alternative music. It was always the stuff that wasn't in the charts. And that's what the business behind my programme is, really. It's all the stuff that you know it, as my age you would know
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Always played in what they called the frothy coffee bars.
That's right.
The cellar bars on jukeboxes, but never was in the charts. But you know it.
Yeah, it's a sort of soundtrack to your life
yeah,
back then, isn't
and so
it?
So the programme covers a bit of jazz, R&B, Motown, soul, quite a bit of ska music, blue beat, stuff like that.
And the wonderful thing about that kind of music, it tends to pinpoint a period in your life and a memory, doesn't it? And usually
yeah.
a very happy memory.
That's right, yeah.
And it just gives you that lovely
sort of
lift.
Like, yeah, mid-60s, early-60s, right through.
Yeah.
It's still going now. And Vectis has given me a great opportunity to play that music again.
So how did you get the opportunity to sit behind the desk and put your headphones on and play?
Vectis had been going about 2 months. I've been out of fire service for quite a few years. I've done bits and pieces, keep the old grey matter going, and I thought, well, I'd write to Ian, and I wrote to Ian.
Did you know Ian?
No. I'd heard of him. Well, he actually interviewed me when he was at the other radio station.
Yeah, so you related knew him from a previous service.
And so I knew of him. And I wrote to him. He said, well, come down and make a cup of tea and help out. And we was operating outside then the little box in the Key Arts. Very, very small room. And he said, you want to do a show? I said, well, yeah, I wouldn't mind if you don't mind. All voluntary. And it went from there. So from about 2 months in, I've been with Vectis ever since. And I like helping them in other ways, you know. It's not just the music, it's presenting and
putting the painting. Christmas decorations up.
Christmas decorations, yeah. Put them up, take them down, put a light bulb in. And I've got on with Ian, and, you know, great bloke. Deserves every accolade, really. Doing a great job he is
wonderful.
For the community.
And really, you know, I think it's an exciting time now for Vectis, isn't it, when we're going into this switching to FM in the new year, which has come around so quickly.
Well, that's right, 2017 it'll be here, and away we go.
And we're doing everything we can to raise the money for the equipment we need to make that happen.
Yeah.
And keep the community work going and promote the community, which
is... we've always said, you can listen to us. We're available on everything except FM, and from probably Easter onwards, it's FM as well, so there's no excuse.
Yeah,
the community station.
Be brilliant. And are you coming to Navy Knickers and Nick
TV's?
Yes,
I will be. Yeah.
Brilliant.
We've got to support all these events, yeah.
So that's a comedy night with me, and more importantly, Donna Jones, MBE, who's a very funny lady, a very talented poet and storyteller, raconteur. So we're having an hour at from 7 o'clock, January the 26th, which is a Thursday. So hopefully you won't be out sort of hightailing it, having a drink and meal or cinema. That's one of those nights, quiet nights. So come on down Thursday, 26th of January, 7 o'clock, Riverside Centre. And you get the biggest bonuses. You get to meet Marco.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he'll tell you all about... He might even throw you over his shoulder. How about that? Fireman's lift.
Yeah. Give you a fireman's lift, yeah.
Yeah. Can you do that? Or is that just a joke?
No,
you can
do that. Yeah. That was part of your training.
Yeah.
You had to lift someone of your own weight up and down the ladder.
Right. And any hideous accidents with that?
No, because the person that you put on your back is on a line.
Right.
Some of the lads couldn't do it, they'd just throw them off.
No.
They'd walk away, they couldn't handle it, and so the person would just be hanging on a line. But that's what you had to do, someone of your own weight.
And that's still a thing?
That's still a thing, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I just want you to tell me, because you're married, aren't you?
Yes, yeah.
I want you to tell me that that's how you met your wife, you rescued her from a burning building and you gave her a fireman's lift. Please tell me that's how you met her.
Unfortunately, no.
Oh.
We met at a party. I was drunk and was leaning over an electric fire. And she said to me, do you realise you're on the electric fire? And I said, no, thanks very much. And I think we exchanged a telephone number and I met her the following week.
So she saved your life?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow. Oh, well, that's even better, isn't it? I mean, how ironic is that? That's just the best.
And that was a long
best
while
story.
Ago, so.
I probably just burst everybody's eardrums by laughing. I'm sorry,
no,
apologise
for that.
Nothing
like that at all, no.
And how many years?
42 years we was married last week.
Wow. Okay, so what's your secret?
I don't know. I've got no idea, really. I suppose we're just happy, get on together. And, you know, you work at things, don't you?
Yeah.
And I think the job helps you as well. As I said, it's a calming type of job afterwards. You're a bit more respectful. So, yeah, it all comes together.
Lovely. Well, it's just been an absolute joy talking to you, Marco.
Thanks for having us.
Really lovely. Thank you for that. And listening to Marco's show, I'm going to say it one more time. Wham, bam, a lama long. Is that right?
Have I said it? Wham, bam, a lama. That's it. If you listen to Little Richard.
Yeah. Fantastic.
Tutti Frutti. Wham, bam, a lama.
And still on the theme of music, please tune in again next week when I'll be talking again. It's a second chance to listen to my interview with the Isle of Wight's music man, Paul Armfield. So that's a nice kind of in Twixmas, as I believe the time between Christmas and New Year is called. So that's next Friday. In the meantime, obviously it's a very special time of year now coming up. So it's Christmas! Have a lovely, lovely time. And, you know, just give love and enjoy being with special people. And if you can't, just love the ones you're with, in the words of the song. Okay, very Merry Christmas. Happy New Year. Take care. Bye-bye.
www.vectisradio.com